Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Our Matrix server is about as free as internet chat can be. Join the existing rooms or create your own at chat.freetalklive.com.
We've been focusing tonight on the insane war on drugs and the first state, Oregon, that has attempted to do something a little unusual, and that is to follow in the footsteps of Portugal and decriminalize possession of all drugs, small amounts of all drugs. They did that in a vote in 2020, but how's it been going? We haven't really, until now, at least I haven't, seen any kind of overview of the results. And thankfully, The Atlantic has published one, and they've looked at various different aspects of this. Jim Hinch is the author, and we've been kind of digging through this and commenting on it as people who, I think I can speak for you, Jay, you want to see an end to the war on drugs, right? Sorry, I've got you muted. Now I can
hear you. Yes, I do.
And so, you know, we've been longtime advocates of ending the war on drugs here. Now, this isn't a true end to the war on drugs. This is just a step in that direction. So you can't legally buy or sell the drugs. You can't legally manufacture them. So you haven't really got a free market in anything here.
So this still incentivizes the fentanyl and the opiates because when there's a black market, mm-hmm. when everything's illegal, just like when there was alcohol prohibition, people were going blind because they were making the alcohol so powerful.
Yes, that's right.
It didn't matter if you had, 200 proof alcohol or if you had, 2-proof alcohol, you were still going away, there were still going to be men with guns enforcing this, prohibition. No, doesn't matter what
so
it
you
is.
So you take the risk for the more dangerous stuff.
So this is what brought us, the meth. This is what brought
us crack.
Crack. Mm-hmm. This is what brought us fentanyl.
You're absolutely right, and that's a great point. And we actually had Dana from the Drug Testing Center up in Vancouver on the show, Dana Larson, several weeks ago, who made the point that when you actually have legalization, you see a trend towards lesser strength versions of these things. Like you can get cannabis in so many different forms today that are not as strong. You can still get the strong stuff, but there's a real movement of people that just want to have a light dose, or they want to get the THC-8 or CBD. There's so many different things. You can take it in ways that are less strenuous instead of just smoking it. Now there's edible cannabis as well at various different dosages. You can measure your dosage, which is, of course, as you pointed out with the black market and heroin, you have no idea if there's fentanyl in there. You have no idea what you're getting from a black market dealer. So you're right. They haven't solved the problem of the drug quality, of the drug consistency, by actually legalizing it and making it available through your local Walgreens.
Yeah, like it was 100 years ago.
Exactly. So that's one problem. But what are some of the other problems? Well, it turns out the money is a problem. We were talking, we haven't really gotten into the details on this, but we were discussing earlier how governments, whether they be left authoritarian or right authoritarian governments, these are organizations of people who've sought power, who want to use that power and the money that they get to steal from people through taxes or through printing it. They want to use that power and the money to reward their friends in industry, right? Like, so you get contracts for their buddies or their family members, or they hire their, their son's friends or whatever. There's all the nepotism and stuff that goes on. Well, there's money involved in this, too. They mentioned at the beginning of the story, hundreds of millions of dollars, they said, that were going to be going to the so-called treatment programs. So instead of funding law enforcement, the idea is to fund treatment programs, which on its face sounds like a better idea, right? Like, because we know that law enforcement isn't making anything better. We know that arresting drug users isn't making their lives better. it's likely going to result in them being even more impoverished when they get out of jail, because if they had a job, they probably lost it. If they had an apartment, they probably lost that too when they get out of jail for the drug possession. So we know that that way doesn't work. So why wouldn't it make sense to fund the treatment program? So how's that going? That's what they address here in the story. So Tony Morris, who's from Oregon Recovers, who initially opposed the measure but now supports funding the policy, says, quote, if you take away the criminal justice system as a pathway that gets people into treatment, you need to think about what's going to replace it. And I think that I mentioned before, that is part of the problem here. The central concept of managing things from a central location of government, central planners saying, well, now that the law enforcement isn't there, we need to have a government treatment program, or we need to have a government way of funding all these other private clinics or whatever it is that are going to be popping up. And what I think should be happening is we should just let the market handle this. Instead of having to take in hundreds of millions of dollars in cannabis taxes, abolish the cannabis tax, let people buy cannabis at the price that cannabis should be sold without
all the taxes. Regulate it like tomatoes.
Right. And then let them donate money to the organizations that the individuals believe is helping. Because you know that the money that's going to be coming out of this fund the treatment programs is going to be going to their buddies. It's going to be going to their buddies who are then running these treatment programs, which may or may not be doing things like you talked about before, you know, paying $7,000 a head to take over a hotel and house a bunch of homeless people there for the rest of their lives.
So the thing with these treatment programs, so the methadone clinics, so I have someone who's almost a relative that, you know, was in the methadone clinic for a while. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have two people that are basically relatives that were on the methadone clinic. And I'm like, so when do you get off methadone? And they're like, oh, you don't.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like,
what?
So basically the idea, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but what I understand is there is no getting off of methadone. The idea, the guy, so I had this conversation with two people about the same, one was a woman. And she's like, oh, there's, you know, methadones, like you just, it's a maintenance thing and there's no, and she's like, I'll ask, what's the end game here, you know? So the woman
I don't
like,
believe it.
What was like, well, no, they don't, there is no end game to get off methadone. You're basically on methadone for the rest of your life. And it's just, you know, a thing so you don't have the withdrawals and, you know, you're not uncomfortable and I guess detoxing from heroin is like really horrible. And the other guy,
I've heard, and I, you know, it's just what I've heard, and I'm looking into it right now, but I've heard that you're looking at least a 6-month tapering down if you're going to do it. It takes a long time, maybe it's 6 years. I don't know. I remember hearing a large number to get off of methadone, get off of heroin, that sort of thing. But it can be done, and in my opinion, it absolutely should be done.
Right. So I know people who have done it. They've gotten themselves weaned off it. So one guy.
But the pharmaceutical industry obviously wants you to be on it for the rest of your life.
Right. And they want a dependency class, too. That's the other thing, too, is these people are going to vote to get their methadone. They're going to, you know, vote mm-hmm. and make sure that they got their welfare check for their heroin. So this other guy who was into heroin, and he was a contractor dude. He framed houses and roofed and did all this, you know, kind of stuff. And he was on methadone for 6 years, maybe. I don't remember, but it was a long time, you know, 6 years. And he hadn't done any actual heroin, only methadone. And he would drive to that, you know, methadone clinic every morning before work, get his methadone, and go about his day. And he wanted to go snowmobiling, like, you know, way up north in Maine or Canada or something, to where you're going to be gone for several days.
Mm-hmm.
And he weaned himself off to methadone. He's basically started, you know, just, you know, skipping methadone treatments every,
good.
You know, going 48 hours with it or whatever, without it, and, yeah. you know, or trying to take a smaller dose. I don't know about the dose part, but he definitely skipped some. And he got himself to where he could go, you know, snowmobiling with his buddies, you know.
How long did it take?
I'll have to ask him again. I still talk to the guy. He's a pretty good guy. But it was a goal that he was working on for a few months and had obtained it. And mm-hmm. he was, you know, very, you know, disciplined. And, you know, he was like, I smoke more cigarettes, you know, when I'm, you know, working off it or whatever, but he's been, I think he's gone 3 years now, totally nothing, no opiates at all. In fact, he got into an accident where he had to go in the hospital, and he's like, please don't give me any narcotics, no opiates. He's like,
pain.
He's like, I don't want to be, he goes, yep. I would rather hurt.
Yeah.
Just,
let me feel it.
Even if I beg you for painkillers, please don't give me painkillers. This is what he's telling them.
And they didn't.
They didn't. But they were pretty
I had a friend as well, Jay, that I, in Florida, a roommate of mine who was addicted to, I think it was like oxycodones or hydrocodone, one of those opiate prescription drugs, and he was shooting it up, you know, crushing it up, shooting it up. And he ended up kicking that habit himself by tapering, I believe he tapered down, and was using cannabis, actually, to sort of supplement his need to feel something, right? Like to have something to be addicted to or something to use. He called it the marijuana maintenance program, was what he called it.
This guy definitely did that also.
Yeah, and it worked for him, you know?
Another thing, too, to bring up is Ibogaine. I don't exactly
Barry Cooper know. Swears by that stuff. He does Ibogaine treatments down in Mexico.
Yep. I worked with there was a guy I became good friends with in a Denver Bitcoin center where I was living in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And he ended up working for IbogaineClinic.com, I believe. He was like their IT website dude. And his sister had been basically hooked on opiates since she was like 14 years old. And she was like 26, 27. And as part of like his deal is like, well, I'll do this if you guys send my sister through to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And the sister, it's been 2 years since I've talked to this guy. But, 5 years after the treatment, the sister had not relapsed. She did not go back into it. But basically, from what I understand, is Ibogaine like resets all your dopamine receptors and your stuff in your brain back to like when you were born.
Mm.
And I could be wrong about that, but that's what I understand about it.
Yeah, I've never done a lot of research into it, but I know some people swear by it for treating this sort of thing.
It's had, that guy was very, he was so moved by his sister getting cleaned up, and then he basically did a thing where he got a whole bunch of people, like, his sister's friends, to all go and clean up, and he basically said that everybody who went and did it had very positive results for a year, at least a year or so afterwards, but the sister had done 5 years and stayed clean and productive and happy and got her kids back. It turned into a beautiful thing.
I've heard good things about psychedelic mushrooms as far as treating people with serious addictions as well. Let's go to the phones here. We got somebody who a caller ID says is in Portland, Oregon. Caller, you're on Free Talk Live. Who is this?
Hey, this is Rusty.
Rusty, are you in Portland, Oregon or nearby?
Yes, I am.
All right. Welcome. Yes. You've been there in the midst of this drug decriminalization. What do you have to say about it?
Well, Oregon deserves some props, first of all, for being ahead of the class in body freedom. I mean, no other state has pulled this off, and it makes it a very libertarian place despite its liberalness.
Mm.
But it's been kind of crazy here because people are very scared of, like, fentanyl, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got mass disinformation. Like, you got these videos of EMTs and first responders, like, having panic attacks and thinking they're overdosing if they're just in the same room as the stuff.
That's weird. Why would they think that?
Because in, like, 2016, the DEA put out some false information saying, like, you could overdose from fentanyl just, like, by skin contact and stuff.
Yeah, that sounds like total nonsense.
So that is nonsense, caller?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't even see why an EMT would even believe that.
Well, I mean, we have a pediatrician in, Concord, New Hampshire that, has DCYF going to try to take J.R. Hole's children because J.R. Hole gave him some ivermectin and his pediatrician believed that ivermectin was so dangerous that a guy's children should be taken away from him.
Crazy.
So you have a bunch of brain dead idiots, in these positions of authority and power.
What do you think, Rusty? Are these people, these critics of the drug decriminalization claiming it's making things worse? Are they onto something or is that total BS?
I just think the timing made it okay. The fentanyl crisis hit around the same time or a few years before, right?
Yep.
This was going to happen anyways. There was going to be fentanyl all over the city anyways.
Mm.
But people, they were trying to pass because of the open air drug use, they were trying to pass some bill in Portland alone to criminalize open air drug use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they mentioned that here.
Now, instead, a bill passed just recently that recriminalizes fentanyl above a gram. And so the mayor of Portland was like, well, that's good enough. I'm not going to do the open air drug use criminalization thing.
Mm-hmm. So hold on a second. A gram of fentanyl.
That's a lot, right?
Well, I used to. So there's a drug that we used to give horses that was you crush it up into a powder and mix it in their grain.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 gram of that would, you know, that's quite a bit. Like, you'd give, yeah, like, that, 1 gram of this butte to, like, an 1,100-pound horse.
Yeah, as I understand it, fentanyl, you don't need a lot to get the desired effects, right?
But a gram would, right, like, fill up, like, 3 thimbles, right? Or something, or 2.
I don't know about that.
Of this stuff it would, but I don't know if, yeah, the same thing is. But
that's
that sounds
how
like
this bill is going to kill people, because it's, okay, it says either you can have, if you have 5 grams or more, it's a felony, right? Or 25 user units. So if you just have 25 pills or more of the blues, then you're going to get a felony. But you can have up to 5 grams of the powder fentanyl, which is way more fentanyl than is in 25 user units or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to incentivize people to use the powder fentanyl, which is injectable, whereas the blues that are going around right now that everybody's doing is not really injectable.
Mm. What's a blue?
Like a pill.
A blue is a little pill. It looks like it's like a fake oxy or something. That's just fentanyl. That's what everybody's smoking. Is these blues?
Hmm.
It's just fentanyl pills.
Is that what's causing like the people on Kensington Street in Philadelphia to be like bent over at the waist and just kind of in that zombie like
yes.
thing? Okay.
Basically. Now, if the syringe exchanges here have said they're collecting way less syringes now because literally people are switching from injecting heroin to smoking these pills.
Wow.
Because they like them so much, they're willing to go back to smoking and stop shooting up because mm-hmm. you can't shoot up the pills. But because of the way this bill is worded, it's going to incentivize the powder version and lots of people.
So people are going to go back to shooting up, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Wow.
Every time they try to fix something, they make it worse, right?
That's what it seems like. What other things are you seeing, Rusty?
Well, interesting thing you were talking about, like the drug testing, you can't test it, and you don't know, or whatever. Well, there's like a nonprofit here that got a mass spectrometer.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And drug addicts can bring in samples of whatever they want. And they'll test it for you.
That's awesome.
And tell you exactly what's in your stuff.
That is really, really awesome. Have you ever gone down there? Have you met any of the people involved in that?
Yeah.
Do you
it's
know?
It's called Outside In.
Outside In?
Is the nonprofit.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds a lot like what Dana Larson is doing up in Vancouver, the guy we interviewed several weeks, if not a couple months ago, who did the exact same thing. He got drug testing equipment, like high-quality equipment, not just chemical tests, but actual, you know, spectrometer-type things, and they are doing the exact same thing. You can come in there for free. You don't have to pay for this service. You can have your drugs tested of all sorts. They'll tell you, you know, wait around for 10 minutes, you get the results, and then you at least know what you're putting into your body. And that is a big, big help for people that have, in most cases, no clue what they're buying on the black market.
Do you use any of these substances yourself?
No.
Okay.
But it sounds like you know people who do.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who lives in Portland knows somebody who does.
Now, how do you feel about how long you've been in Portland for?
About a decade.
So has this drug decriminalization, in your opinion, made Portland a better place to be or a worse place to be?
I don't know the answer.
Well, I think he said what he said earlier, Jay, was he thinks it was just bad timing because he thinks that whether or not the drug decrim happened, you were going to see the fentanyl overdoses shooting up, and so to speak.
Yep.
Happening.
On top of that, we're dealing with the economic implications of the lockdowns happened right then, too.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, businesses are going out of business. Like, we got economic problems going on.
Right.
Taxpayers are leaving. Taxes
are going up. Which is what leads
to
people to use more drugs. As I was saying earlier, when people are bummed out and they think their life is terrible and they don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. And we predicted, by the way, when the lockdowns went into effect, we said there's going to be more drug overdoses. There's going to be more people that fall off the wagon that maybe they'd quit using drugs or going to start using drugs. And we said there's going to be more suicides. And all of that stuff came true because those people didn't have anything to live for, at least so they thought.
So you probably know some folks that are like living on the street and basically just career drug addicts, for lack of a better description.
Oh, yeah.
And are those folks receiving some form of welfare that you're aware of?
Some of them, yes.
Okay, so do you know some folks that are like living in, you know, in the drug encampments that aren't receiving any form of welfare?
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, and so what do they do for money? How are they coming up funding?
They're probably selling drugs.
Well, a lot of them have jobs.
Really?
Like even the homeless ones, yes.
Okay.
They just want to live on the street so they don't have to pay rent, right?
Yeah, they don't have money for rent, but they have a job.
Okay.
They have money for drugs.
Kind of jobs are these guys working? Because if you're like, I don't know, a homeless guy, you know, working a retail job might be a little, not tolerable for the customers. So do you know what kind of like jobs these guys work?
Well, there's like, you know, like one guy I know works at a laundromat, for instance. Mm-hmm. Doing like security,
right.
And it's like a 24-hour laundromat.
Yeah, sure. I mean, people working in factories, they don't have to smell great.
Sure. Okay.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Very interesting, Rusty. Anything else you want to share about your experience tonight?
Well, I got one more question.
Jay's got another question. Go ahead.
So back to the welfare correlation thing. So you know some folks that have overdosed. Of the people that you personally know that have overdosed on these substances, are they more of the working class guys or more of the welfare recipient type?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. I believe that.
But I do know a good number that are not on welfare. And I also know quite a few that are not homeless either. So, I mean, there's all stripes. The problem is the most visible of the fentanyl users and the other drug users are the homeless ones. Those are the ones you're going to see smoking on the street because they don't have anywhere else to smoke.
Do you believe that, from the people that you know, do you know anybody who specifically moved to Oregon so they could do drugs?
No, I do not, and I'm wondering why.
Interesting. Rusty, thanks for the call tonight, man. I appreciate your expertise and your experience. Appreciate your call. The number here is 603-283-6160. That's 603-283-6160. If you want to weigh in, we got time for you. Coming up here on Free Talk Live, you can join us. It's Ian and Jay. We're coming up.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
USA News Update. Good day for investors on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average continued to enjoy a winning streak Thursday. The Dow closed higher for a ninth consecutive day, its longest winning streak since 2017. Overall, Wall Street closed mixed as corporate earnings season continues. The Dow was up 163 points. YouTube is bumping up its price on some of its platforms.
YouTube Premium is now $2 more and is priced at $13.99 per month. Those using YouTube Premium Music will see a dollar increase in its plan to $10.99 per month. A spokesperson for the streaming giant told 9to5 Google that the rate hike shows the value of the ad-free services, noting its music app has more than 100 million songs. I'm Matt Mattinson.
The Federal Reserve has launched its own instant money transfer service. FedNow allows individuals and businesses to send and receive payments within seconds. It'll be available 24/7. I'm Ryan Daniels, USA News.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pouty Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit shopsupertea.com. The first word is shop, spelled S-H-O-P, then the word super, and then the word tea. The complete website is shopsupertea.com or call us at 818-984-6100 Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-984-6100. shopsupertea.com.
Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with ever is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or you now need affordable health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Health Insurance Helpline can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and people just like you that need affordable health insurance to get it. We have short and long-term health insurance plans, and some even cover dental, vision, and prescription drugs. Don't take a risk with your family's health insurance. It's not worth it. If you're self-employed or now need affordable health insurance, call right now and learn for free how to get it. Listen, affordable health insurance plans for everyone just like you are a free phone call away. So give us a shout right now.
800-670-0946. 800-670-0946. 800-670-0946. That's 800-670-0946.
We still do email. Drop your email address in the entry box at freetalklive.com, and you'll be kept in the loop with Free Talk Live.
Yes, it is Free Talk Live, and you can join the show. We are talking about drug decriminalization. And how's it going up in Oregon? Very grateful to hear from somebody who's actually in Portland. We have, I think it was Rusty calling in a moment ago. It's Ian and Jay tonight. The number is 603-283-6160. We're sharing a story from The Atlantic, which is very in-depth. There's no chance we're going to get through it. It's very long. But lots to talk about in here. And, of course, we'll share that with you on our social media site, which you can join. And you can interact with other Free Talk Live listeners. Some of the hosts are there as well. It's over at social.freetalklive.com. Once again, that is social.freetalklive.com. We're running our own server. We set the rules, and there aren't many rules. One of the rules is no spamming, and the other rule is no snitching. If you see somebody on the site you don't like their opinions about something, then just hit the block button. We don't want to hear about it. So head over at social.freetalklive.com. I want to go back to the story here from The Atlantic. And we are talking about Measure 110, which passed in 2020. This allowed the decriminalization of small amounts of all drugs, including, you know, crack or methamphetamine, heroin, etc. And is this a success? Has this been a success? Well, what Rusty pointed out a moment ago in Portland, he's in the thick of it there. He says he thinks that it was bad timing. Because some of the numbers have gone up. Some of the addiction, death numbers, that sort of thing, have gone up. He said that probably would have happened anyway because the fentanyl use was on the rise. And decriminalization isn't necessarily going to stop people from using drugs, although we had seen numbers in Portugal for the last two decades that suggested that almost immediately there were fewer people with problems with addiction, more people were seeking treatment, that sort of thing. So they're saying that they think that the answer is to put more money from the government into treatment. And I think one of the problems with that, first of all, they've absolutely failed, apparently, at handling the money. They get into that later on in this story.
As always, every government project.
Right. But you know what they're going to do is they're going to give money to buddies of the people in the government. And that's going to be incredibly wasteful. Because whenever you're spending other people's money, even if you aren't corrupted, which of course it will tend to do anyway, but even if you aren't a corrupted individual, you will still be better, or you're going to be better at spending your own money. You're going to be more judicious with it. You're going to be more choosy about how you spend that money. Whereas if it's somebody else's money and there's no real, you know, accountability for it, maybe you're not going to pay as much attention. Maybe you're not going to be as concerned. And we see that all the time with government handouts. It's not being done effectively. That's why government welfare is doing such a piss-poor job, and private charities like the Salvation Army, for instance, can actually do a much better job at helping people for a fraction of the price.
A little explanation about this, how wasteful government is. So in 2007 or 2008 campaign year, we hosted what was called the Massachusetts Liberty Riders. So my dad and I, we would go load up a trailer full of horses and go to these parades and put any Liberty candidate on a horse. And we would end up riding them through whatever. But there was this one guy, his name was Kummel Jane. He was a second generation Indian fella. He was an accounting guy. He was he worked in some accounting department for the state. And one of the things he did is he had interns that were from colleges that he could, you know, have them work on assignments. So one of the things they did is they calculated that how much did it cost for every $1 of welfare that a welfare recipient got, how much did it cost the taxpayer?
How many dollars did they have to pay to give $1 out to somebody?
$42.
I was going to guess low. I was thinking $8 or $10 or something that.
For every $1 a welfare recipient received in welfare.
State welfare.
Yep, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It cost taxpayer $42. And this guy was running for, I believe, state auditor. And he actually worked in the auditor's office. That's what it was, auditor. And he was running for, so this was one of his campaign things. Mm-hmm. It was like, nobody's talking about this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why taxes.
That's $42 going to the bureaucrats, going to their buddies, going to the contractors, right?
Yep. So you get a family that's getting $1,200
ridiculous
in these assistants, and it's costing the tax slaves $50,000 a month to give these people $1,200 a month. It's crazy.
It is insane. And that is something that absolutely needs to end. So that same thing you're talking about there, Jay, with the ridiculous ratio of spending, it's going to go on with this treatment money, the millions of or dozens or hundreds of millions of dollars that they have from the cannabis taxes that they're going to be doling out to these treatment centers.
Yep.
It's going to be the exact same thing where they're spending 20, 30 times as much as they really need to spend. So they're not going to be giving people the help that they need to, like an efficient organization that actually has to earn its money. That's the difference, right? Like a private charity that isn't on the government dole has to earn your support. They have to show you that they're actually helping people. They have to show you that they're doing it affordably, that they're spending, target is it's a 90% of any organization, it's a private charity. If you can get that 90% of the donations going to the actual purpose of the charity instead of paying overhead, you're a really good charity. That's what you want to shoot for. So a lot of them do. A lot of them make that.
The state does two things. They do what's called deficit spending, to where they essentially borrow money that's created out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
And then they point guns at people to force them to pay taxes.
They do. So many advocates, according to the Atlantic story here on drug decrim in Oregon, say the new policy simply needs more time to prove itself. Even if they also acknowledge that parts of the ballot measure had flaws, advocates worked closely with lawmakers on an oversight bill that passed last month. quote, "We're building the plane as we fly it," said a program supervisor at a homeless services provider in Portland who helped put the measure on the ballot. Haven Wheelock said further, "We tried the war on drugs for 50 years and it didn't work. It hurts my heart every time someone says we need to repeal this before we even give it a chance." And the good news is it has not been repealed. I don't know if that's going to pass. Hopefully it doesn't, because I do agree that as flawed as this is, it is still a step in the right direction. They say here that Measure 110 went into effect at a time of dramatic change in U.S. drug policy. Departing from precedent, the Biden administration has endorsed an increased federal funding for a public health strategy called harm reduction. Rather than pushing for abstinence, harm reduction emphasizes keeping drug users safe, for instance, through the distribution of clean syringes and overdose reversal medications. The term harm reduction appeared five times in the ballot text of Measure 110, which forbids funding recipients from mandating abstinence. And I agree with harm reduction as a policy. I think it is generally a good idea. The idea is essentially you accept that drug users and, more importantly, drug abusers, because drug users don't have a problem. They just like to do drugs occasionally. Drug abusers, you know they're going to do the drugs. You know they do them because they do them when they're prohibited. You know they don't care about the law because they'll get arrested. Then they'll get right back out and they'll keep doing drugs. So, like, it hasn't solved, it being illegal hasn't solved the problem. So you accept that these people, they're going to do drugs. Unless we can solve the problem at the root and give them some sort of, you know, positive view on life and change their perspective, you know they're going to do it. So the idea of harm reduction is let's make it so they can do them without overdosing, without getting drugs that are tainted. So Rusty gave us the example of that facility that you can go to in Portland, walk in, give them a sample of your drugs, have them test it. I suspect they're doing it for free, like the place in Vancouver is doing it, and actually find out what you're about to put into your veins or into your bloodstream. That is a harm reduction measure, and it is something that actually can save people's lives, because people knowing what they're doing is one of the things that you almost never get in the black market.
And let's not forget who's one of the biggest importer of drugs into the United States of America is the government. So we've had Silver Dave on the show, former mm-hmm. Special Forces, and he reports that Afghanistan was basically, you know, where the military was, you know, essentially subsidizing and, you know, participating in the cultivation, the harvesting, the processing, the
transporting. He said they were guarding the crops.
Guarding the crops. There was like drug, you know, heroin processing facilities that they were not allowed to do anything about. You know, they could have just totally, the U.S. government could totally stop the whole, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, was militaries from 70 nations of the world occupied Afghanistan. And it was literally during that time, and there's newspaper Washington Post articles on this, mm-hmm. opium production increased 8,000% since while the U.S. right. was occupying, because the politicians want the junkies. The politicians want the dependent class.
Absolutely.
If you are an addict, you are the ultimate slave. And here's another thing we need to know. So in the 80s, what was it? It was the CIA basically invented crack. And was very much behind that. This Ron Paul is quoted several times discussing, you know, how when the CIA didn't have to report how they made their, you know, so the CIA didn't need to ask government for funding, could do their own funding, and they didn't have
because they were selling drugs.
Because they were selling all these drugs. So they're pushing the cocaine, they're pushing the crack, they're creating this epidemic, you know, mm-hmm. in all the cities. They were targeting, you know, black people, black communities, with crack. These designer drugs, you know, where did fentanyl come from? You know, fentanyl is extremely addictive.
Oh, they want to blame China for that one, Jay.
Well, maybe. I mean, but as far as I'm concerned, you know, China's government, the CCP and the American government, the CIA. I mean, we know Biden's bought and paid for by the Chinese, by the Ukrainian, and the thing is, too, is like if you don't want your kids to be on drugs, One of the first things you can do is not let them use internet devices, within the first 6 years of their life, because the part of the brain that is stimulated by the internet device is the same part of the brain that's stimulated by cocaine and opiates. So, stop using these internet devices as pacifiers and babysitters. Stop stimulating that part of the brain. Also, stop feeding your kids sugar. Stop feeding them fake sugar and all these seed oils and junk food, because sugar is actually the gateway drug. That white sugar that you buy in a 5-pound bag in the store is the same exact mechanical process is used to make cocaine as it is sugar, from molasses. And
well, that's a whole other story about sugar taxes and incentives and government subsidies and all that nonsense.
But just don't get your kids into it, even tickle or stimulate the part of the brain that is going to really respond when they try a little bit of, one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
When the doctor gives them an opiate when they're, 15 years old and they get their arm busted in a, football accident or a car accident or whatever, and the doctor gives them something that's an opiate, if that part of the brain that opiate is going to stimulate has a lot of neurological pathways made to it because the kid sat in front of an internet device for those brain development years,
it could get them hooked worse, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
So they say backers of Measure 110 said the law was modeled on drug policies in Portugal, where personal drug possession was decriminalized 2 decades ago. But Oregon's enforcement and treatment referral system differs from Portugal. Users caught with drugs in Portugal are referred to a civil commission that evaluates their drug use and recommends treatment if needed, with civil sanctions for noncompliance. So it's not like they just cut you, loose and let you walk away. There's still a system there. Portugal's state-run health system also funds a nationwide network of treatment services, many of which focus on sobriety. Sutton says drafters of Measure 110 wanted to avoid anything that might resemble a criminal tribunal or coercing drug users into treatment. Quote, people respond best when they're ready to access those services in a voluntary way. And I totally agree with him. This is the director of external relations for the Drug Policy Alliance, who they're interviewing here.
I think if you're pretty comfortable getting your disability check and smoking your crack like my uncle did until the day he died, you're not interested in any treatment.
No, but should you be forced into it?
I don't think you should be forced into it, but if you're committing crimes, if you're stealing from people and stuff like that, he was stealing things from, literally my grandmother,
members.
My entire life, and other random people. Mm-hmm. And I went into a Walmart with him about 8 years ago in Cobeskill, New York. I had picked him up for something to help me out. Security walks right up to us and says, "You can't be in this Walmart." And the security guy let me, he's fine with me, but they just escorted him right out of the store. And he's like, "Hey, can I have the key to the truck?" I'm like, "No. I'll be back there."
Upon the truck.
Well, whatever. Some tools or something. But the security guy goes, "Oh yeah, we have facial recognition software,
really?
And we were alerted as soon as you guys were in the parking
Whoa.
Lot, and basically we were like,
that's awesome,
20 feet in the door." And you look at a Walmart, it's like a prison or a casino with all the cameras they have.
Yeah, they have a lot of cameras.
But
that's impressive. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and this was upstate New York like 8 or 10 years ago, and they're like, "Yeah, facial recognition," and we were alerted, and basically I was at the back of the store, the guy says, and it took me from here to get to you.
Yeah, I'm fine with that, by the way. I don't care if a private company wants to use that technology.
I
think that makes sense.
And that works good because he's had stolen so much stuff from him over the years.
He's a liability. He's a walking liability.
And any Walmart he goes to in the country, he just can't go into.
Oh, that's really cool.
From what I understand.
Makes sense. People respond, he says, when they're ready to access the services in a voluntary way. And I totally agree with that. Almost immediately after taking effect, Measure 110 encountered problems. A state audit published this year found the new law was vague about how state officials should oversee the awarding of money to the new treatment programs.
Of course.
It set unrealistic timelines for evaluating and funding those treatment proposals, and as a result, the funding process was left largely to the grant-making panel, most of whose members, quote, lacked experience in designing, evaluating, and administrating a governmental grant application process. So there's all this bureaucracy around this money. They got all this money. They want to give it out, supposedly, but good luck getting to it. Good luck getting through the mountain of paperwork that you would need to get this funding. Whereas, again, if we just simply allowed the market to work, allowed people to keep the money that they earn in the first place and donate it to the organizations doing the good work, this would be solved instantaneously. I mean, it's not all problems will be solved, but the problem of distribution of resources will be solved by those who are most efficient at doing that. They will be the ones that rise to the top. They will be the ones with the success stories. Like here in town in Keene, there's a homeless shelter that is privately run. And they've been around now for more than, I don't know, roughly 15 years. And they do this. I mean, they do take a little bit of money from the city, but it's by no means a huge chunk of their budget. So they do this on largely donations from people because they can point to the success stories that they've had, helping people who are homeless actually get into housing, actually get jobs, showing the wins, essentially, and getting people excited about it, funding what they do. The audit described a chaotic process with more than a dozen canceled meetings, potential conflicts of interest in the selection of funding recipients. Huh. That's a shock there. You got buddies lining up for this. Lines of applicant evaluations left blank. Full distribution of the first biennial payout of cannabis tax revenue. $302 million was earmarked for this. That's a lot of money for harm reduction, housing, and other services. Didn't occur until late 2022, almost 2 years after the measure passed at the ballot. Figures released by the state last month show that in the second half of 2022, recipients of Measure 110 funding provided some form of service to roughly 50,000 quote-unquote clients, though the Oregon Health Authority has said that a single individual could be counted multiple times in that total. A study released last year by public health researchers in Oregon found that as of 2020, more than 650,000 Oregonians required but were not receiving treatment for a substance use disorder. So this is a failure of centralized control. This is a failure of the state, ultimately.
But it's not a failure for the state. For the centralized controllers, it's all profit to them. Another thing we can look at is we talk about Mike Gill once in a while.
He's a researcher here in New Hampshire, right?
Well, he's a lot of things. But mm-hmm. So anyways, Mike Gill is a guy who he used to run a thing called New Hampshire State of Corruption, which all states are states of corruption.
Of course.
But basically he says that the governor, Sununu, that Gene Shaheen, who is a he talks about Shaheen or Shanahan. One of them's a federal representative.
Shaheen.
How Shaheen's husband runs his like New Hampshire trust thing.
They're attorneys.
They're basically trafficking all the fentanyl through this, New Hampshire trust, and there's a New Hampshire trust called, the Boston Bank Trust something or another. And he talks about how all this money, all these drugs and money are being trafficked by the government. Mm-hmm. The government's doing it. It's the lawyers, it's the accountants, it's the bankers. It's the same people that Jesus Christ had a hard time with. Who are doing all the same evil deeds.
More
today.
Things change, the more they remain the same.
And he goes on and on about this. And so the thing is how are all these drugs getting to all of these drug encampments and users? And it's with a lot of help from corrupt government officials, from, the thing with Afghanistan to the thing with getting it in from China to, all these border patrol and customs guys. They know who's coming through with the drugs. I mean, there's these stories how there's like one guy was like smuggling drugs and he would pay a border patrol guy $40,000 cash a month.
Sure.
And
be
like,
the other way.
I'm going to be driving car, such and such with a license plate. What lane are you going to be in? Mm-hmm. He says to the border patrol guys, I'm at lane number 3 and I'll be coming through there. And, and so this is just happening at every level.
Sure does.
And literally every city police department is in on it. Almost every sheriff department is in on it. Even if the sheriff doesn't know about it, there's a whole bunch of guys within his department,
sure.
organizing this, making this happen. And it's just very easy to look the other way, and it's very convenient.
This is prohibition, what you're describing. I mean, anytime you have this, whether it's alcohol or the current prohibition, the results are always the same. The corruption is rife.
And this is where a blanket, straight up, like Daryl Perry used to always say, you know, you regulate heroin like tomatoes, is going to take all these guys out of it.
That's right. And that's why they push so hard. That's why they want to keep things the status quo.
Yeah,
and they don't want to lose that that revenue.
And the judges are happy to convict the drug addicts and put them into jails because the judges make money. Everybody just makes money. They're all invested in their court registry investment scheme. They're all shareholders in these private prisons. They're shareholders in these companies that service the prisons if they can't legally own shares in the prisons. It's such a scam.
So let's talk about other failures here. Meanwhile, the new law enforcement provisions have proved ineffectual. Of 5,299 drug possession cases filed in Oregon Circuit Court since the decrim went into effect, 3,381 resulted in a recipient failing to pay the fine or appear in court and facing no further penalties, which, as far as I'm concerned, that's good news. According to the Oregon Judicial Department, about 1,300 tickets were dismissed or pending. A state audit found that during its first 15 months in operation, the treatment referral hotline received just 119 calls. This is in 15 months. 119 people called for the treatment referrals, which costs state taxpayers, or I guess cannabis users, because again, they're taking money from the cannabis taxes, $7,000 per call. So they took the budget of this hotline and divided it by the 119 calls.
Of course.
A survey of law enforcement officers conducted by researchers at Portland State University found that as of July 2022, officers were issuing an average of just 300 drug possession tickets a month statewide, compared with 600 drug possession arrests per month before the measure took effect, and close to 1,200 monthly arrests prior to the outbreak of COVID-19. So they are still issuing hundreds of tickets, but it is a fraction of what they were doing just a few years ago. And again, that's good news as far as I'm concerned. They cannot arrest their way out of this problem, and they can't ticket their way out of the problem either. And the Drug Policy Alliance guy they interviewed earlier is absolutely right. If you take somebody who is a drug addict and who is intending to continue being a drug addict, and you tell that person, well, now you have to go to treatment, you're actually harming the other people who are in treatment program.
You see this in AA, where part of the probation mandate or parole mandate is that they go to AA meeting twice a week or something. And then the people who are there, you know, because they're ordered to be there are, you know, they're making it uncomfortable for the people who are actually there wanting to, you know, get help.
Those people who want the help do not need to be around people who are going to egg them on into other, you know, going back into their addictions or possibly sell them some drugs or whatever. Out of time for tonight. You can join us between now and the next show over at freetalklive.com. And you can join us online anytime. Check out our social media at social.freetalklive.com, our chat server at chat.freetalklive.com, and we'll see you soon.
Attention, your money is now controlled by the U.S. government.
Picture a world where your every purchase is monitored, tracked, and controlled by those in power to suppress the freedoms of those they see fit. Hi, my name is Jason Hansen. I'm a former CIA officer and New York Times bestselling author. And right now, I've become very focused on the impending rollout of the central bank digital currency. This is not a work of fiction. It's a terrifying reality looming on the horizon. But there is a bit of good news. I've partnered with Advantage Gold to offer you a solution. They are specialists in converting your traditional assets, like those inside an IRA or 401k, into tangible assets such as physical gold and silver. Don't allow your money to be controlled. Claim your free gold protection kit from Advantage Gold. Call 800-900-8000, 800-900-8000. That's 800-900-8000.
Advantage Gold is not an investment advisor or a tax advisor.
Call 800-900-8000.
All right, crew, let's get her dug.
Honey, you want to give me a hand? I'm planting that tree, remember?
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. You must call 811 at least 2 to 3 business days before any digging project, so you can avoid hitting our essential buried utilities. This includes natural gas and petroleum pipelines, electric, communication cables,
and water and sewer lines. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811. Brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.